listening to The Worried Writer, helping you to overcome fear, self-doubt, and procrastination to get the work done. I'm your host, Sarah Painter, and I'm a novelist and self-confessed worried writer. For show notes, resources, and much more, please head to worriedwriter.com. And now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 9 of The Worried Writer. I am recording this intro on the 3rd of November, 2015. Thank you so much for joining me. November means one thing for a lot of writers, National Novel Writing Month, or NaNoWriMo. I'm not taking part officially, but I'm definitely trying to get as many first draft words done as possible. I'm aiming for 30,000, which probably doesn't sound very ambitious, but it's quite a lot for me, especially as I have a couple of parenting or life things going on during November, which are going to take up quite a bit of time. I'm going to keep the intro really short today, as the interview with my guest, Catherine Ryan Howard, is quite long. I could have cut it down, of course, but I didn't want to. Catherine is so warm and funny, and she gives wonderful advice. Catherine is a self-publishing superstar, now a hybrid author. She just signed a, well, not just signed, but she has signed a deal with Corvus for her thrillers. The first of these, Distress Signals, is out next year. In the interview, Catherine mentions the release date as June, but since recording, it has moved to the 5th of May. That's the 5th of May, 2016. I'm very excited to read it. It was really interesting to speak to Catherine after the interview with Joanna Penn last month. Joanna Penn, of The Creative Pen, has published both her fiction and non-fiction herself and is very pro-indie. It's not to say that she's discounting traditional, and she does have an agent, but Catherine Ryan Howard has alternative views on the value of going traditional for fiction. The key for me, and the thing that I have taken away from these conversations, and the thing I find truly exciting, is the range of choices we have as authors these days. You can choose the best option on a per-book basis. Whereas in the past, there used to really be only one way in which to get your book into the hands of readers, there are now multiple options, and that is just really thrilling. In writing news, I've had a bad few weeks, to be quite honest, in which my brain appeared entirely empty, and I freaked out a bit. I actually decided to write about it on worriedwriter.com in a piece which seemed to resonate with lots of people. I'd felt a wee bit nervous about being so honest about how rubbish I was feeling and how rubbish I was being, but I really needn't have worried. Lots of kind folk commented or sent me messages of empathy and kindness and advice. Do head over to worriedwriter.com and see the piece, The Only Way to Defeat a Bad Writing Day, and join in the conversation. Speaking of conversation, people have continued to share and say nice and helpful things on Twitter and Facebook. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the support that you guys are showing to this podcast, and it really helps to know that I'm not just shouting into the void, although everyone likes a shout now and again. On the shouting theme, I'd like to give a quick mention to some Twitter folk. Terry, who is TJ Long, Kim Foster, who is at Kimberly Foster, Nikki Malherb, I'm sorry if I'm saying that wrong, who's at Nikki Malherb, and Harley Christensen, who's at Mischievous Marley, who said my interview with Joanna Penn was truly inspiring. Thank you, Harley. And Marie Madigan, who's at Marie the Madigan, who was kind enough to say that she is now working her way through the podcasts. Yay! I hope you enjoy them, Marie. Thank you to everyone for sharing and subscribing, listening and talking about the podcast. If you could spare a couple of minutes to leave a star rating or review on iTunes, I'd be hugely grateful. Ratings really are very, very helpful. As I'm keeping it short this episode, I'm not going to answer a question, but please do get in touch if there is something you'd like me to cover in another show. You can email me at sarah@worriedwriter.com or find me on Twitter at Sarah R. Painter. I'm also on Facebook, / Sarah Painter Books. Okay, now onto the interview section of the show. Catherine Ryan Howard self-published her light-hearted memoir of working at Walt Disney World, Mousetrapped, back in 2010, and followed this with a travel memoir, Backpacked. Through these publications and the excellent guidance she has provided through both her blog and her book, Self-Printed, The Sane Person's Guide to Self-Publishing, she has developed a successful business as an expert in this field. Catherine has delivered workshops and talks for the Faber Academy, the Guardian Masterclasses, and the Dublin Book Festival, among many others. She has also worked with Penguin Ireland as a social media marketer. Last year, Catherine signed with literary agent Jane Gregory, and her debut thriller, Distress Signals, has been snapped up by Corvus, an imprint of Atlantic Books, as part of a two-book deal. Welcome to the show, Catherine, and thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you, and thanks for that amazing introduction.
Well, you've done so much.
I feel like I have to live up to. No, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. But yes, writing the intro, I was just thinking you have done an awful lot. So
yes, and what's amazing is the amount of Netflix I managed to watch while I'm doing all this stuff, because I sound a lot busier than I actually am, I think. But, you know, we won't tell anyone.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm going to have to get you to reveal all on that now.
there's really not much to reveal. You just laze around a lot and then you do everything you need to in the, like, you know, you just start to work when it's already too late to get the thing done. That's how I like to operate.
That's a top tip. You heard it here first.
Yeah, that's the name of my, you know, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People style book. Don't start until it's already too late.
Perfect. Well, as I was saying just before we hit record, I've been a long time follower of your blog, and I know that getting a traditional deal has been one of your major goals. So huge congratulations on signing with Corvus. Could you just start off by telling us a little bit about Distress Signals?
Yes. Well, Distress Signals is the shorthand that I've been telling everyone, which I probably have to stop doing, is that it's about a serial killer on a cruise ship. So the longer version is that my narrator is called Adam. Mm-hmm. And his girlfriend, who's called Sarah, actually, disappears while on a business trip. And a few days after she does, he gets her passport sent to his home, to their home, with a note that says, "I'm sorry, S." And this leads him to track her to a cruise ship called the Celebrate and a man called Peter, whose wife also disappeared a year before. And Peter also received a passport with a note from his wife inside saying, "I'm sorry, E for Estelle." So he, you know, what's the possible connection between these two women? They don't know each other, but they both disappeared from the same cruise ship. And so it goes from there.
Wow. That sounds fantastic. I cannot wait to read it.
Well, you've a long time to wait. It's 9 months now.
I looked at the counter on your blog. It says 9 months. I thought that's very neat. I like that.
Yeah, it's, as I said, it's my kind of, you know, thing that will be here in 9 months. Social media announcement. Because, you know, when you're on Facebook, you have to, like, see everyone's babies and engagements when you're married anyway. And I decided, you know, I want my thing that'll be here in 9 months, and I much prefer that.
So. Your book baby.
I'm sure the time will fly, though. Like, you know, I know I'll be here in 9 months time saying, "God, like, where did the time go?" And I'm in college as well, so I'm pretty certain I will be saying that. But it is kind of a weird process, because, you know, everything happens sort of by telephone and email. There's very little, like, tangible, you know, thing. I suppose when I see, like, maybe a proof copy or something like that, I'll feel differently. But it has been a very weird experience.
I wanted to ask you, as I mentioned, you've written, you know, 3 non-fiction titles which you published independently. And I was wondering how you found kind of ceding control, because now obviously you have an agent and you're working with a publisher for your novel. And how have you found that?
Well, I was never, you know, one of these self-publishers who banged on about control, because for me, you know, control is a very relative term. Like, yes, you get to decide on the cover, and yes, you get to decide when it comes out and stuff, but ultimately you have no control, because at the end of the day, you can't force people to go out and buy your book. Mm-hmm. So to me, you have no control over, you know, the biggest part of the operation, which is whether or not people will buy it. Now, at the same time, in the sort of process of the book, like right now, actually, I'm supposed to be getting a look at my cover for the first time this
exciting
week. Well, I have this, like, pit, you know, dread. Uh-huh, uh-huh. But you know, my goal was always to get published, and there has never been a day in my life, and, you know, people will, this is quite controversial, but there has never been a day in my life when I thought self-publishing a novel would be better for me mm-hmm. than getting published. Mm-hmm. And yes, you know, there's a certain element of control, but I feel like, you know, I know what I'm doing. I think I'll have, you know, more of a hold on what's going on. I'm not one of these authors who, you know, will sit at home and wait for them to tell me what's happening with marketing uh-huh. or what's happening with this. Like, I said to them, you know, I see it more as a partnership that, now financially it's not a partnership, but, you know, I feel like I'm going to do everything I can. I'm sure they're going to do everything they can. And I have confidence that they will, you know, uh-huh. like, I think one thing that authors don't really acknowledge very often is that just because you're offered a deal, like, it doesn't mean you have to take it. Like, you can sort of investigate whether or not you think this is a good publisher. You can look at their other titles. Uh-huh. You can meet with them and judge for yourself if you think they're going to be as on your side as you are. And, you know, I feel very confident. So I'm sure there will be things where, you know, I'm a bit like, that's not how I would have done it. But I'm not a publisher. Like, I'm mm-hmm. not someone who's been in the business for the last 10 or 20 years. And, you know.
No, I always wanted to get a traditional. I always wanted to be published for fiction.
Yeah.
It was always my dream. And that's what I dreamt of from when I was little. And so rightly or wrongly, it's not, I'm not saying it's for everybody, but it was yeah. what was super important to me.
Yeah.
And I also, I think reading things like your brilliant self-publishing book and and following lots of authors also made me have quite a realistic expectation. And also that, just, you know, just as you were saying, a sort of partnership thing, this sort of business mind.
Yeah.
When you're going into a publishing deal, it's to recognize that you are, you're, what they're bringing to the table is their expertise.
Yes.
And if you're signing with them, you are making the business decision that you trust their expertise. And yeah. I'm not saying you have to blindly then say yes to everything.
Of course.
But equally, yeah. it's sort of the deal you're making.
Yeah. And I think
if that makes any sense.
No, it totally does. Mm-hmm. And like, when you read, you know, the sort of more angry, shall we say, self-publishing accounts online, there is a sense that you kind of surrender. Like, if you mm. if you get a book deal, a traditional book deal, you have to surrender yourself and your book. Mm. It's not it's like not, that at no. all. And if it is like that, you know, something is wrong. Like, I'm very early in the stage of my experience, and I'm sure there is people listening who are saying, you know, yeah, she's going to discover, like, you know, it's not all sweetness and light as she thinks it is. But I do feel like I'm going into this eyes open, and I've already seen, you know, I think editing for me was quite an eye opener, because obviously I hired editors, and nonfiction is totally different, but I did work with editors, and I'm sorry, but there just is not the same level of investment. Mm. Like, I had my agent's in-house editor editing my book. And then I had my actual editor who bought yes. the book at Corvus editing it as well. And, you know, this is her job. This is her, you know, employment. This is her profession. This is her reputation. And, you know, yes, you hire an editor and they can do a fantastic job and they can be very conscientious, but they're just not, they don't have as much at stake in the process if they're just like a freelancer that you've hired for the job. And, you know, I wonder if at some stage I had, let's say I'd gotten like loads of rejections and years had gone by without a deal, you know, the version of Distress Signals that I would have self-published if I had wouldn't have been the version of the book that exists now that these people sort of got out of me, you know? So I have seen already, you know, benefits, I would say, to being traditionally published, not to mention like the money upfront aspect, which yes. people kind of fail to mention.
Well, it's you quite know. Important, isn't it? Finances are it important.
It is, because why would you want to take the risk mm. when someone else is prepared to take it for you? And if they give you an advance, you know, that makes them work harder because they have to try and get that money back.
Absolutely.
On their investment. So, but as I said, I am quite early. I am quite early in the process. So maybe call me in 6 months and I'll be like, Damn it! I wish I self.
I don't think so. I think you really have such a sensible mindset, and you know your stuff. I don't think that's true at all. But I'm so happy for you. And as I say, I'm so excited to read the book. It just sounds amazing.
Thank you.
So, obviously, you run a successful business, which includes speaking on independent publishing and writing and so on, I believe. Yeah. And you're also, I think you mentioned, you're also doing a degree in English.
Yeah, so, just for fun.
Yeah, you know, as you do. So how on earth do you fit everything in?
Because this is the truthful answer, because I don't do much else.
Okay.
Like, really, you know, I'm not married. I don't have kids. I don't even have a goldfish. So my time is all my own. And really, about, you know, 5-6 years ago, I'd been away for a while and I came back to Ireland and I just took an office job for a year. And I was just getting more and more miserable. And I felt like, okay, you know, I'm going to go all in. I'm going to go all in on this writing thing. I'm going to like throw myself into it, be committed 100%. And I really, you know, ignored everything else in my life just to make this happen. And so it's quite easy, you know, when it's your full time. No, well, I wouldn't say easy, but it is my full time job. And you know, when I look at the list of things I've done over the last 5 years, it sounds like I'm very, very busy. It sounds quite amazing to me. I think, like, how did I have time to do all this? But it's all quite spread out. And what I really discovered last year, especially, because the reason I went to university is because I was sick of waiting to sort of get a book deal. And, you know, I wanted to do something that I had control over. Uh-huh. And I wanted to put the focus into another part of my life instead of just like waiting for the phone to ring or whatever. And then 6 weeks in to my 4-year degree, I got an agent. And then just before my first year exams, I got the book deal. So that plan really worked out. But what I discovered, like, in the last academic year, I have never worked as hard as I did. Like, I was just a stress bunny. I was completely, you know, no relaxation. I couldn't relax. There was so much to do. I was trying to, you know, be at university and pass my exams. I was trying to rewrite my novel. I was also keeping up my freelance work. It was incredibly difficult, but I realized that, you know, it sounds funny, but I felt prior to that, I didn't deserve to get what I wanted because I wasn't working hard enough. You know, it looked like I was, and I felt like I was, but I wasn't. And all these people around me were getting book deals. And, you know, I couldn't feel like, oh, that should have been me, because they were working harder than I was. And it was only when I really worked as hard as I possibly could that I got the agent and the book deal, because I think I felt like I'm working hard enough to deserve it, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does.
So I really think you just have to push yourself. Like, if you asked me, you know, 18 months ago, like, I used to hate when people said, you know, kind of smirked at people who said, I'd love to write a novel, but I don't have the time. Because I used to say, look, you don't know people's lives. Like, you don't know whether or not they have the time. But now I would smirk too. Because I have, no, really, I have discovered, you know, that if you want something bad enough, you will get it done. You will make the time. And it will involve actual sacrifice. It will involve, you know, waiting a few weeks to watch Orange is the New Black instead of, you know, streaming it the second it becomes available. Like, you will have to put other things aside, but it's worth it, I think.
Oh, that's fantastic. I couldn't agree with you more. I'm nodding away here. And I think you're so true. It's so right when you say actual sacrifice, because I think people... Oh, I certainly include myself in this. I sort of heard, you know, you need to sacrifice things, you need to make the time. And I sort of heard all of that for a long time before I really, truly grasped that didn't mean that I actually somehow had a free pass, that I would find a magic feather.
Yeah.
No, it really meant me as well. I really did actually have to set my alarm
when,
and wake up and into it.
You know, I would go, yeah, that's so true. Like, you know, and I would think I had got it. I would think I had understood. And then, you know, I would go home and watch TV or, you know, read someone else's book. But really, you have to, like, if you're managing your schedule, you're probably not working as hard as you could. coping, because it really has to get to the stage where, you know, things are a little bit out of control maybe, and you're slightly exhausted. And it, I also think, like, the more you write, the more you want to write.
Yes.
So if you really, even for a week, pretend you're doing, you know, NaNoWriMo or something, and you write whenever you can, it'll get to the stage where even if you have 10 minutes, you'll want to sit down and, you know, add a few words. Like, I really think the more you do it, the more you want to do it.
Yes, I think that's true. And so in terms of process, do you... You know, you're saying obviously this is what you do full time, and you do your degree as well, also full time. We won't count the number of full time things you do, because that will make you cry. But do you have some sort of schedule that you try and keep to during the week, or a particular time that you try and write, or 9 to 5, or take weekends off, or what's your sort of really nitty gritty to your?
Well, I have absolutely no schedule.
Okay.
Because I'm really a binger.
Okay.
So you know, I discovered that it's far easier for me to sort of pull out all the stops and do nothing but write for a month, let's say, you know, no social engagements, like have Tesco delivered, put aside everything else and just like bang out however many thousand words. It's far easier for me to do that than it is for me to set an alarm at 5 a.m. every morning and get up and write for 2 hours. Like, I just can't do that. I can't sustain it. So I really don't have a schedule. I'm just a binger. So like, usually I concentrate on one thing at a time. Now I will be stopping my freelance work, because after the last academic year, I have discovered that really I can only do two things well at the same time. And three is a big push. And I have a much bigger push to do this year, because I have to write a book from start to finish between now and April.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So that's going to be fun. So that's what my plan really for the coming year is, to kind of very loosely, you know, concentrate on college during the week, and then, you know, dedicate my weekends to writing, because I need that time. Like, I need a good stretch of time to get anything done. But I don't really have a schedule. I have a lovely planner from Erin Condren that I absolutely adore, but that's, you know, you can play with it, you can put stickers in it and get out the colored pens and stuff. It's a form of procrastination as well, but I do keep track of things. Like, I am very organized in that sense. But in terms of like a daily schedule, I don't write every day. I don't, you know, do anything like that. My blog is quite haphazard at the moment. I'm more of a sort of set aside a block of time and focus on the most important thing that needs doing.
Well, that sounds very sensible. That sounds like a good way of doing it. And do you, when you say track, do you, I mean, I'm a compulsive tracking person, and I write down what I've done each day. Do you write down, you know, the tasks that you've completed that day in a kind of like tick off sort of, well,
it's
done
more
me sort of a way?
Aspirational.
Okay.
And then I write down the things I hope I'm going to get done.
Oh, nice.
And sometimes some of them have to be carried over to the next day. I do like to track how many words I've written. I think there's sort of a psychological thing with that, because I love getting, and I have one ready now for the next couple of months for my first draft, I love getting a calendar, you know, a wall calendar with lovely big boxes for the days. And I have it up by my desk and I write in how many words I've done. And if I don't write any words, I have to put like an X or something. And you get to the stage where you will sit down for half an hour and write any old crap just so you can put your words, you know, your number into that box instead of an X. And I think that really, really helps you, because as well, you know, you think sometimes I don't like forcing myself if I'm feeling tired or anything. And I think to myself, well, you know what, I'm going to take today off and I'm going to read a book or I'm going to do something else that needs doing. But that can so easily turn into two or 3 days. And I think that if you have that visual aid in front of you, you know, the guilt will prevent you from taking more than one day off. So I do like to track in that sense.
I think that's a really good tip. And speaking of the next book, I was going to ask you at what stage you're at with Distress Signals at the moment. Is it all edited and sort of
done. I'm actually expecting the copy editors, the copy edits today.
Okay.
Later today. And I'm told there's a day's work in, you know, sort of accepting or rejecting those changes. And then it will go off to be typeset.
Wonderful. So really close.
Yeah, that will probably be the end of me, you know, doing any sort of writing. I mean, it will be the end of me doing any sort of writing work in terms of that novel. But I'm just starting the second book, which, you know, makes me feel ill.
So do you have a, did you have an idea for it already when you got the two book deal?
Or was it funny what happened? I did have an idea, right? But it was quite a flimsy one, because I had spent years of my life just focused on, you know, the book that became Distress Signals. And my agent asked me to just, you know, send a synopsis, send anything, you know, to say that I had more than one idea. So I sent off what I felt was like a flimsy synopsis. And when I went to London to meet my editor for the first time, we were sitting there and she, you know, we were kind of going through things and she kind of went, "Now, there is something I have to talk to you about, book two." And I knew what she was going to say, which is that, like, that idea was, I mean, she didn't say it was rubbish, but like, she basically said, "Do you have anything else? Do you have any other ideas?" Uh-huh. And
great.
It was, I know I was like totally put on the spot. So I did have one good idea and two crap ones. So I brought out the two crap ones first and she was kind of nodding. She was like, "You know, yeah, what, you know, what else do you have? What else is in there?" And I had written, like, I had read, sorry, an article about this serial killer in Sweden. And the story in the article wasn't what interested me so much as the blurb at the top of the article, because it was whatever way they had set up the story, it just sounded fascinating. Uh-huh. So I told her I had read this article and I told her about the blurb. And I said, you know, I thought if you could write a novel that would fit into that blurb, you know, it would be amazing, which was kind of a cover up of saying, like, I don't have the story that was fit into that blurb, but I think I could come up with it. And she said, "That's the one. That's the one." So over the summer, I've been basically figuring out the details. And now it's time to sit down and write a first draft.
Oh, gosh.
So it is a serial killer again, but it's on land this time. No, you can't write two books about a serial killer on a cruise ship, because it's a bit, you know, can't go down that road.
Unless it is a sequel and it's...
I don't do series. Can't deal with series at all, no. So it'll be standalones. Yeah, so just a little matter of writing that before April.
Yeah, that'll be fine, I'm sure, no problem.
Oh yeah, no problem at all. Just as long as, like, Starbucks, you know, plumb a line of coffee into my apartment doesn't think
it is hard with the second book, though, isn't it? Because you do, most people spend a long time on the book that gets published. It's not necessarily their first book, of course, but because I know I'd spent quite a long time writing The Language of Spells and then working on it with my agent and all of those things that you just like you mentioned, and then, you know, dream come true, two book deal, what's, you know, could you write another one
now.
To this time. Yes, now. Okay. So I really empathise. That's all I wanted to say. I super, super empathise,
well,
but it's going to be fine.
I empathise with myself because I don't know how I'm going to do it. But at the same time, you know, I think it's a different kind of exciting because, you know, I have been thinking, I mean, it was 2011 when I got the idea for the book that became Distress Signals. And it was 2012 when I started seriously, you know, writing it. And now I have like I don't even have 9 months, I have like 8 months to write another one. So it is going to be, I think it's going to be kind of thrilling, you know, in the way that standing on the edge of a cliff is thrilling. But I am looking for, it'll be a different experience. And I'm, you know, I am looking forward to getting stuck in and sort of starting afresh.
Yes.
And having brand new characters and sort of being able to do whatever you want. And I think, you know, I have Distress Signals on my Kindle. And anytime I start to get freaked out, I read a few pages of that and I think to myself, you did it.
Yes.
You've done it already. You can do it again.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's a really good idea. And it's true. You have done it before and you will do it again.
Yeah.
But yes.
Let's hope.
Deep breaths. So to go back to the beginning, as it were, this is the question that lots of people get asked. And of course, I usually ask it as well. Have you always wanted to be a writer?
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. I mean, I've wanted to be a writer since I realized, you know, people wrote books. Uh-huh. Like when I was very young, like when I was like 5 years old and I went to what we call junior infants, like your first year in school, mm-hmm. The teacher used to sit up on the desk and read to us, like in the way that, you know, she'd hold the book so we could see the pictures, but she'd be reading out the words. And I used to go home and put all my Barbies and my teddies on the bed and sit up on my dressing table in the same way and, like, you know, quote unquote, read to them. And of course, I was making it up because I couldn't read. But, you know, that's, I've always been like, I feel, telling stories and things like that. And I have a picture on my desk of Christmas morning when I was about 8. And I'm sitting there in my nightgown with my legs underneath me. It's on my blog if anyone's
seen
it.
I have seen
and
it.
And I'm playing with my typewriter that Santa mm-hmm. brought me. You know, I've always, always, always wanted to write, and not just write, like, but be published, because for me, that's the closing of the loop. Like, I, you know, yes, I write diaries and stuff for my own benefit, but I write fiction because I want other people to read it. I want to give other people, you know, the experience that I've had with fiction, where you curl up on the sofa or you get through a flight or you pass a day on the beach, you know, immersed in a book. And that's why I write. So, like, I know people say, oh, I write for myself, and, you know, I write without thinking about an audience. Like, I'm sorry to be unromantic, but I don't do that. Like, I write with the end game of someone else reading it, because for me, it completes the loop.
Absolutely. But I think that you have to write at some point for the reader if you want to be published, or you're intending to put books out for readers.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's...
I always kind of have a little giggle when people say, you know, people who are published or who got book deals, when they say things like, oh, I, you know, I was just writing it for myself. Like, I was just writing... Because I think, did someone break into your house and steal the manuscript? Because at some point...
At some point, absolutely.
You sent it out, you know, so...
You must have been intending.
Yeah, there must have been some point where you're like, I want someone else to read this. So I think it's important, if you want to get published, to have an awareness, you know.
I think Stephen King says in his On Writing something about, you write the first draft
with the door closed.
Yeah.
Love then, that.
Which is, second, I think that's, yeah, I think, and I think that's so, well, obviously, if it works for people, of course, it works for me. I think that's a really good way of doing it, is that you tell yourself the story to get out of your head. And then you sort of think about the effect it's going to have and the reader's experience as you're working on it.
Yeah. And that's something else I discovered, like, in this whole process, is that, again, you know, we were talking about how people would say, oh, you have to work hard and you have to make sacrifice, and we'd smile and nod, but really we weren't getting it. It was the same with me and first drafts, because people would say, you know, the first draft of anything is feces.
Yeah.
And I would be like, yeah, you know, that's so true. But really, then I was at home getting frustrated because my first draft wasn't, you know, amazing. But what I've really discovered is, like, you cannot write a good first draft, or sorry, a good second draft, without writing, like, you know, a fairly all over the place first draft. Like, I really learned to trust the process, and you know, how many drafts you have to go through to pull out, you know, something that works, basically. So that's something else I'll be reminding myself of when I sit down to write book two.
Yes.
It's okay that this is rubbish, because, you know, in the future you'll pull something out of it that is slightly less rubbish.
And don't compare your wonderful finished distress signals with
your first, anyone else's, you know, book.
Yes.
Like, you know, is there any worse despair than writing a first draft and then picking up a finished book that has been through God knows how many drafts and been edited by at least one person, copy edited, proofread? I mean, you just can't compare the two.
Don't you feel as well, though, that you've really learnt through writing multiple drafts and rewriting and so on? Because, again, I do follow your blog, so I do know that you've been through this process. do you feel now that you've learnt a lot through that about what it actually takes to...
Oh, absolutely. Mm. And I've learned that the only way to learn it is through writing. Because for at least 10 years of my life, while I was off, like, gallivanting and stuff, I was obsessed with reading about writing. Like, I have read every, you know, popular how to write a book. You know, name them. I've read it. I was obsessed. Every year I would go into Waterstones on Patrick Street in Cork and buy the new edition of like the Writers and Artists Yearbook or whatever. And I didn't need any of it, but I thought like that was the way to learn. And I never learned, you know, anything from those, like really just the education of writing one novel yourself in whatever way works for you. You know, it was worth 10 years. It was worth 20 years of reading those books, you know, and I would have had a lot more money as well if I didn't spend all my money on those books. You know, really the only way to learn is by doing it, really.
Yeah. And what is your process? Do you plan or do you dive in with no clue?
No, I'm a big planner. I absolutely love Save the Cat by Blake Schneider, which is actually a screenwriting book, but I go by, you know, the beats of a screenwriting method, basically. So I start off, I think of it like, and I think he uses the description in the book of a clothesline. So my plot is the rope. And I have to have, you know, a point at the start holding it up and a point at the end holding it up and then a few points in the middle so that it doesn't sag. And I sit down with, you know, my ruler and my highlighters and my Sharpies and whatever other procrastination materials I can find. And I make a big chart and I sort of plot out the major points. And then I would write a first draft and then I would go back and I would be able to plot, you know, maybe 15 major points. And then I keep, you know, refining. So I don't usually know the whole story. I definitely know the beginning and the end and, you know, maybe a tent pole in the middle that holds it up. But for me, you know, I couldn't just sit down and sort of meander my way through it, because with a thriller, you know, it's all about plot. It's almost all about plot. And my editor would kill me if she heard me say that, because she's mad into me being like characterization. Yes, but when you're writing it,
it's pretty vital for a thriller. Yeah, yes, absolutely.
It is about plot. So yeah, but you find then as well, I mean, you know, you have to write it. Like some of the biggest twists in Distress Signals weren't there at the beginning. You know, they came in the writing. So there's only so much sitting down with Sharpies you can do before you have to just dive in.
And then on rewrites, do you have any tips for rewriting a plot-driven, complicated thriller?
Well, I was lucky in that I didn't have to do too much structural rearranging. I did have to rearrange the order of events in one part of the book. But what I found is that, like, I actually love editing. I love revising. Like, that's the fun bit for me. The bit I don't like is the first draft bit where you have to actually come up with it. Like when you've been away from it for a period of time, which I would have been, like I would have been away from it for about 2 months while it was copy edited and stuff, you know, you just see it so much more clearly. And when it came to reordering those events, you know, it just came to me, like, if I moved that here, it's kind of like a chessboard, isn't it? You know, I just think if I move that piece here, then, you know, this piece can come here and then it'll be even better. And the one thing I do, which, you know, I think maybe is not for everyone, is I retype the whole thing. So I sit down. I can't be one of these people who, like, surgically goes in, you know, to the middle of a chapter and does things. I can't deal with that at all. So I have like two documents open on my screen, the new one and the previous one. And I make a list, like I have my little chart again, but instead of what happens in each chapter, I have a list of what I have to change in each chapter if I have to change something. And I retype the whole thing.
Wow.
Because I just find, you know, I just find it so difficult to do it otherwise. And I think that works, you know, that works better for me. But what I've also discovered is there is no right way. There is no single right way. And you should just do whatever you have to do to write and finish the book.
Absolutely.
Like whatever works for you. If you write it backwards, whatever. Mm-hmm. Whatever yeah. works.
And just try different things until you find the thing that's working for you, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in terms of this podcast, as you may know, is called The Worried Writer.
Is there any other kind? I don't know.
So I was just wondering if we could delve a little bit into any sort of struggles that you may have had. Do you ever suffer from a creative block or procrastination, or is there any particular part of the process that you find most difficult, or when you're most likely to be struck with fear?
It would be easier for me to tell you about times when I'm not, which is like never. I'm a master procrastinator. I procrastinate all the time. And like one of the sort of defining moments of my writing career was it was sort of May 2014. And for about a year, I had been writing the first third of the novel, which at that time was called Dark Waters. And I had two friends, Sheen and Hazel, who both of whom are published now. Hazel is a New York Times bestselling author. And they were like, you know, send it out. Like, I remember we were sitting in a cafe here in Dublin and they were like, send it out to an agent. And I said, no, because, you know, I knew that you shouldn't let anything out of the house until you are 100%, you know, happy with it, until it was the best it could possibly be, whatever. But they were like, no, no, you're going to do it. Like, you're going to go home and you're going to, you know, submit. And as soon as they said this and got me to agree to it, I felt like a cold sweat break out because I was so anxious over it. And I realized that, you know, what was happening was fear. Like, that was why I hadn't sent anything out. That was why I hadn't finished it, because it was so much nicer to live in the world where maybe all my dreams were going to come true, yes, than move into the world where someone had stuck a giant pin, you know, in my balloon and deflated everything. And it was frightening. It was like terrifying. And I did send it out to an agent who swiftly rejected it. But she gave me, like, the story was very different then. And she gave me, you know, she said, look, this thing doesn't make sense. Like, this mm-hmm. interaction between these two characters. And so I went away and rewrote it and submitted it and got rejected by another agent. But when I got that rejection, I didn't feel like, I felt like it was, okay, it's not for her, but I didn't sort of believe, you know, her criticisms, like they didn't make sense to me. So I sent it out again. And then I had Jane Gregory and another agent both offering me representation at the same time. So, you know, it was just, I had to sort of just, I didn't even push myself through the fear. I was dragged through it by the other two, kicking and screaming. I mean, all procrastination is fear, you know, in some form. But that for me was my biggest struggle that I just had to, because it's very difficult when it's what you've wanted all your life.
Yes.
You know, you don't. I remember being 18 years old and sitting out the back garden of a friend's house and we were talking about, you know, going on to college and blah, blah, blah. And they were like, you know, what are you going to do? And I was like, I'm going to be a novelist. And my very realistic friend was like, yeah, okay, but, you know, what are you going to do if that doesn't happen? And I couldn't even imagine that it couldn't happen. You know, I was so determined is the wrong word. I think maybe deluded is better, because I just completely believed, you know, it was going to happen no matter what. So you can imagine how scary it is to take a step then. I mean, you don't have to imagine because you did it yourself. You know how scary it is to take a step into a place where you're going to find out whether or not
it's going to happen.
This is going to happen. Yeah.
Yes. You've given
I would also say in terms of worried writers, like, it doesn't stop once you get the book deal.
No.
You know, my big thing now is that, and everyone's telling me, like, don't be ridiculous, but I'm telling you, as soon as I got the book deal, my next thought was, I have one book written, I have to deliver another one in April, and then I'm out of contract. Yes. You know, then I don't have a book deal anymore. And I'm worrying about that. So it's, we talk about it all the time here, my friends and I, that, you know, being a published writer or being a writer of any sort, it's fleeting moments of joy in a sea of anxiety and despair. Yes. So, you know, it's important to celebrate the happy moments, because, they're few and far between.
I think that's really true, though, isn't it? You do have to celebrate. Otherwise, we will all get very, very low permanently if we don't celebrate happy moments and celebrate small successes.
Yeah, like I have friends who, you know, they feel they shouldn't have a launch past the first book.
Right.
That, you know, if they have a second book coming out, they think like, well, you know, you really should only have a big party for the first one. I say have a big party every time.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's so much work and there's so much stress and anxiety. I mean, self-doubt is the name of the game, basically. So when the book comes out, you know, you should celebrate it. When you get a good news email, you should celebrate it. Like, you know, be happy with your successes.
Absolutely. And have you found that over time that it's got a little bit easier putting yourself out there? I mean, you were saying obviously it really being pushed to send out what became distress signals. And then once you did it after the first, you know, the first rejection or whatever, you managed to do it again. You managed to send it out again and then again. Do you find that it's getting easier over time, this kind of putting yourself out there? Or
no.
No. Okay.
No. Like right now, my thing is that, okay, how many people, like, this is what I lay awake at night thinking about. How many people have read Distress Signals, right? So there's a friend of mine, Sheena, has read it. My agent read it. A few people in my agency read it. My editor read it and a few people in my publisher read it. So we're probably talking like less than 25 people overall. And in 9 months' time, it's going to be out there. And what are the chances? Because you know what happens, like you hear these stories about, now I did not get like an astronomical deal, but you hear stories of books that did get astronomical deals and everyone in the publishers is like so excited about it and the book comes out and it falls on its face because it's kind of like what probably happened is one person got excited and that excitement became contagious and maybe they lost sight of the fact that the book didn't have a broad appeal or, you know, things like that. So,
well, there's an element of luck to how a book is going to fall, isn't it?
Well, I'm not a huge believer in luck. Okay. Like, I think luck is, you know, what I would say is, like, luck to me, it's not the, I don't know how to say it, it's not the be all and end all. Like I say in self-printed that you should, like, luck does play a factor in terms of timing and things like that, but you should make luck your only variable.
Yes.
And one thing we were discussing with some friends of mine there a few weeks ago, there was a podcast, This American Life, that talked about, I think he was a Somalian refugee and he was trying to get a US green card. You'd be like, where is this going? But he got a green card in the green card lottery, which is this thing that the US has every year where you're just picked out of hundreds of thousands of applicants to get a green card. And they were interviewing the guy's brother who had also applied but didn't get pulled out. And the interviewer was saying, you know, do you feel jealous? Do you feel bitter? And he said, no, because like my brother has wanted this all his life and sometimes luck is fair. So that's how I feel that, like, you know, when you see these books like The Girl on the Train or Gone Girl and other books with girl in the title, there's loads of copies. That's not luck. You know, it's not. Like, there are so many other elements that go into the success of a book. Like, I feel like when you say, you know, so-and-so got lucky, you're taking away from, you know, all the hard work or the quality of the book or things like that. So, and the flip side of that is that if my book falls flat on its face and everyone hates it, you know, I won't be going around saying, oh, I was so unlucky, you know? So luck to me, I try and not think about it, to be honest, because I think it's not a tangible thing that you should factor in. You should just ignore it because, you know, both good luck and bad luck, I ignore.
There's that whole thing, isn't it? The harder you work, the luckier you get.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. No, some people say, you know, you make your own luck, these kind of things. I think, you know, it's not something that people should focus on.
I just think that sometimes there is a sort of zeitgeist thing and something just catches for whatever reason and becomes, you know, obscenely successful. And I think that after a certain level of success, there must be some sort of element of happen chat. I don't know, that's not the right word, but anyway, of luck. But up to sort of normal success levels, I completely agree with you. I think it's all to do with stuff that's controllable, and like you say, it's taking away from both the author and the publisher and the marketing department. Like, and everything it's luck.
I've been in groups of writers where, you know, someone has, you know, got a great deal, let's say, and others sort of like are giving her side eye and saying, gosh, she was so lucky. But no, she wasn't. Like, she wrote
a really marketable book.
Yeah, a really marketable book, which is probably a better way of, you know, describing books that get published. And she did all her work and she didn't send the agent crazy stuff and things like that. You know, I think luck is sort of a little crutch for people who didn't do it the right way and who, you know, don't want to admit it. That sounds very harsh.
You're not leaving yourself any wiggle room whatsoever here. You're being, I think you're quite hard on yourself as well, aren't you?
Well, I just think I'm very realistic. I think I'm very realistic because I've been around, you know, publishing for a few years now and I see what goes on and I just, you know, I think I just have a very realistic.
Which I love. And I love that realistic attitude that you brought to Mousetrapped and to Self-Printed and so on. And obviously the voice that they're written as well. I mean, I shall be putting all links to these things in the show notes. But if anyone listening hasn't read Catherine's blog, and even if they're never, ever going to write or self-publish something, they should read these books and the blog because they're just so well written. And how did you were talking about anxiety and self-doubt there a little bit, and how did you have the confidence, I guess, because to me it's just terrifying. The thought of self-publishing something is utterly terrifying. I mean, all publishing is terrifying, but how did you manage to do that?
To overcome the fear of self. To be honest, if I'd have thought about how many people would ultimately read Mousetrapped, I probably wouldn't have self-published it. I think you have to just not think about it, basically. Like, the reason I self-published was because I didn't have a job. I'd left my job to sort of throw myself into writing. And shockingly, I didn't get a book deal overnight. So had to do something too crazy. I had to do something to support myself. So I was more thinking, very small. Like, the reason I wrote Mousetrapped is because I had gone to the US on an 18-month J-1 visa. And when I was self-publishing, my thinking was that the people who were about to go on the visa program could benefit from reading the book and would be interested in reading it. Like, I wasn't thinking about a broader, wider audience. Like, you know, I went into self-publishing realistic, yes, but really not thinking realistically in terms of readership and the reality of pushing a book on Amazon and stuff. So, you know, the first time I got a review that was awful, like, I was on the floor. Like, it knocked me back. But I just think over time, you know, I try to not let other people dictate what I want to do. And it's such a small minority of people who, you know, go onto Amazon and let rip. And I'm sure they've their own things going on in their lives. So I think you just have to not think about it, if that helps. You know, like, I was listening to Elizabeth Gilbert's podcast there recently, and she was talking to someone who wanted to write a memoir about their family. And she was thinking, like, I can't do it because, you know, I'm thinking, like, Aunt Mary or whatever is going to read what I've written. And that's kind of true of fiction as well. Like, I think I just didn't think about it. And by the time I did think about it, it was too late. The book is already out there. And you just have to, like, you know, when you're a writer, you're constantly teetering between, like, you're constantly on that tightrope between, like, self-doubt and self-confidence. And I think if you're not, there's something wrong anyway. You know, you will always be, like, you know, moving between those two points. And you just have to kind of take a deep breath and tell your inner voice to shut up for a second and press the publish button, because there is an element of risk.
Yes.
You know, there is. And nothing that's worth doing is easily accomplished. You know, you just have to take a deep breath and go.
So a healthy dose of denial.
Yep,
along
denial
with realism.
And delusion. Okay. They're my two
your watchwords.
Tools of the trade.
So in terms of writing fiction, did you feel, or do you feel, sorry, I suppose it's because obviously it's not out just yet. Look out next year, folks. Did you feel any sort of self-doubt or anxiety about, I mean, obviously I haven't read the thriller yet, but about any elements of characterization or that sort of, I was going to say exposing yourself, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it was very difficult for me because, like, you have said now several times about, you know, my voice in Mouse Trapped and stuff like this, and this is a thriller.
Uh-huh.
So this isn't anything like the voice on my blog. It's not like the voice I'm using now, which I think is also how I write. And because I write my nonfiction like just like I speak.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But I had to dial all that back. And I was just talking to my editor the other day, and we were talking about how she calls it chatty. That's what she says when in my thriller about dead people, I sort of veer off into humor. Mm-hmm. Or I kind of, you know, change the tone a bit.
Uh-huh.
And I was saying to her, you know, you should have seen the first draft, because like there was actual jokes in the first draft. And she said, there's still a few in there, Catherine. So I do think that was my anxiety, that because it's also a first person narration, although it's a male first person narration. So I think I probably did that just to stop myself from being myself and just, you know, making the whole thing lighthearted and funny. So it was difficult for me to sort of tone down the tone. But I did have confidence in myself because this is what I love. Like, since I was 12 or 13, I've been reading crime thrillers. You know, I devour them. And I really felt like, you know, I must have read hundreds of them, if not, you know, more than 1,000. Like, so I felt like I knew what I was doing. And I was very, the one thing I would say is I was very confident in my idea.
Okay.
Like, I really believed in my idea. And if I had anxiety, it was about executing the idea. And not letting the idea down, sort of thing. Like, I hate it when books don't deliver on the promise of the premise. Like, when you hear about this, you know, fantastic hook, and you think, oh, that's going to be fabulous, and then you read the book and it just is very deflated and whatever. Like, I feel like they've wasted a fantastic idea that no one else can use. So for me, it's all about delivering on the promise of the premise.
So that's what led you to write a thriller, is the fact that you've always loved...
Yeah, like I always thought I would. Like, okay, that was my plan. And what happened is about 5 years ago, about the time Mousetrap came out, I started talking to a major publisher here in Ireland. And I would meet with them every few months and we would talk about me writing women's commercial fiction. And the reason I started off down that path is because I think that is the genre that matches my like natural voice best, because, you know, I do like to be funny and, you know, lighthearted and things like that. But I don't read women's commercial fiction. I was only doing it because I thought it would get me published, like, to be blunt about it.
And no, that's fair enough. If a professional is, if you're getting that kind of professional encouragement, you're going to listen to it.
They wanted me to try and write it. But any time I did produce anything, they would say things like, you know, the plot just exists so you can crack these jokes. Like, there's no emotional heart to the novel. And of course there wasn't, because my heart wasn't in it. And there was one day around the summer 2012 where because I felt I wasn't like old enough to write a thriller. I felt like, you know, you have to do that when you're weather beaten and you're you've seen all of life and, you know, that kind of thing. And I thought to myself, you know, I'm really not enjoying writing this thing. And when I have this done, I'll write the thriller for fun. And then I was like, hang on a second. Everything I write should be for fun. So at that moment, I ditched the whole idea of writing anything but a thriller. And I just said, look, maybe I can write it. And I got to work.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's so encouraging and exciting. Thank you so much for telling us about that. And did you find you'd had to do a lot of... Was it? I mean, the thriller does sound fantastic. Did you do a lot of research? Did you go on a lot of cruises?
I'm not allowed to tell anyone that I haven't been on a cruise.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm going to go on one. I'm going to go on one before the book comes out, just to make sure.
Oh, I'm never going on a cruise now. I've never been on one. Well, I'm never going on one in case a thriller happens.
I don't really want to go on one.
No, I was going to say.
No, I will. I will go on one.
Mm.
The beauty of this is that people who do go on cruises love telling people about it. There is so many websites, so many forums, and they're really helpful. Like they love putting up articles like, you know, what to know, what you should know if this is your first cruise and things like that. So they're really sort of generous with their enthusiasm and their love of cruising. So I did do a little bit of research, but you know, without giving too much away, only part of the book is on an actual, like it's just the latter half of the book is actually on a cruise. And in terms of the plot, like the actual experience of being on a cruise wasn't crucial. Like I did make sure that everything that I have had people who have been on cruises a lot read the book and make sure that everything is okay in that department. But it's not really, you know, a book about being on a cruise.
But that's the beauty of fiction, isn't it? Is that we can do a bit of research and we make stuff up. And then,
yeah,
like
I would love
to
put in, you know, an author note that says, like, I made this up.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I'm sure there will be someone who immediately runs to Amazon and says, this doesn't happen, you know, but what has that got to do with anything? Like, it's not.
No.
It's not nonfiction. I did make it up. And, you know, I did do research and I am going to go on a cruise. I have been warned. I will have to go on one before the book comes out, just to make sure. You know, and I also think, like, one of the reasons I didn't go on a cruise, not only because, you know, I was a starving artist slash student that couldn't afford it, but I felt like maybe it would have taken over. Mm-hmm. Like, I would have got all this detail I was trying to shoehorn in. And I think it's better to come at it from the other angle, where you write the action and then you sort of colour in the details, because there is definitely a danger with too much research as well.
Absolutely. And also sometimes if you know something really, really well, you're almost too close to it to make to write fiction.
I mean,
about
I did
it almost.
Get, I did wander into a little problem with that, like what I did with the book when I wrote the first draft, because I hadn't been on a cruise. I overcompensated. So I worked as a housekeeping inspector in a hotel with 2,000 rooms. So there's a lot. I mean, it's basically the same thing when you're in housekeeping on a cruise ship. So I kind of took my housekeeping knowledge and I put it into the book to sort of to almost cover up the fact that I hadn't worked on a cruise ship, but hey, I had worked in accommodation and I knew all this stuff. And, you know, I have locations in there where I've been, because a lot of the action takes place like in Nice and things like that. So I took what I knew and I worked it in. And like at one point, a lot of that came out because my editor was like, why is all this? What does this have to do with anything? You know, 3 pages about how to clean a hotel room. So, you know, there is a danger of going a bit heavy handed when you know too much.
And so I guess the takeaway from that is for people to really not worry too much about the whole write what you know, and to really write the story and then worry about the details.
I think you really only have to, I mean, research is different for everyone. Like, you know, I have a friend who writes historical fiction and it is very important, obviously, to get the details right because, you know, you're setting it in a different time period. And if you're maybe, if you have a police detective or something like that, you know, you really have to be careful there. But first and foremost, you should just get the story down. Because you could spend years doing research and never. That's a great form of procrastination. So you might never get around to it.
It's pretty dangerous, isn't it?
Very dangerous, yeah.
So before I will let you go, because I'm conscious that you are the busiest woman alive.
I'm really so happy I have this reputation when I will probably sit down tonight and watch like 5 hours of TV. So
oh, that's research. That's research.
That's totally research.
So just to finish up, is there any advice that you would give people who would like to follow in your footsteps? Or if you could go back to your aspiring author self, what would you tell yourself?
Whew. Well, I did feel for a lot of, I'll say two things. So I did feel, first of all, for a lot of time that I waste time, because I had this thing in my head, like, I'm going to get a book deal by the time I'm 30 and like all this crap. And I really was in, you know, despairing at times, because I felt like, why hasn't it happened for me? Like, I've done everything right. Mm-hmm. I have a job in publishing. I've self-published. I've, you know, great platform, blah, blah. And it wasn't happening. But what I realize now is that it happened in exactly the way it had to happen. Mm-hmm. Like, I could not have written this book 5 years ago. I probably couldn't have written it 3 years ago. You know, so everything happened in the way it had to happen. And the other thing I would say is, you know, a lot of the time when you have a dream that is in some people's eyes impossible, because, you know, everyone talks about the odds. Mm-hmm. And this really annoys me, this talk about odds, because people say things like, oh, less than 0.0001% of books get published. I'm sure that's true of books that are written. OK, that's probably true. But do those odds apply to you? Because when you think of the people who don't write marketable books, mm-hmm. the people who send, you know, if anyone's watched Arrested Development and saw the packages that Tobias sent to agents, he used to send like glitter bombs and all this kind of thing. Like, are you, you know, a person who is going to actually look at what the agent wants and submit professionally? Are you a person who thought about your platform? You know, I remember having a conversation with someone who basically was telling me, you know, that getting published is impossible. Uh-huh. And I was getting quite frustrated and angry with this person in my brain, because I don't do confrontations. I've been, you know, silently seething. And I just had this epiphany at the end of the evening where I thought to myself, oh, she thinks that her and I are the same. And we're not, because she hadn't sat on the floor with the typewriter when she was 8 or Christmas morning. She hadn't mm-hmm. constantly dreamed of this. She hadn't done all her research. She hadn't written a marketable book. You know, she hadn't researched agents. She mm-hmm. hadn't got a job in publishing. You know, like, you are you. And when other people tell you what's possible and what's not, remind yourself that they think you're the same as them. And you may not be, because maybe this is something you've wanted all your life, and maybe you have taken the steps to make sure it's going to happen. Maybe you have a fabulous idea. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you're not going to do the things that the other person is going to do. So it really, it's like salmon swimming upstream. You know, you just have to keep going. Mm-hmm. Listen to yourself. Listen to yourself. And, you know, some people will give you helpful advice, but it will feel helpful when they do.
Okay.
And if it's anything else, it won't feel like that. And you can ignore it.
That's fantastic advice. Thank you so much. So just to finish up, where can people find out more about you and your books?
Well, everything is on my website /blog, which is katherineryanhoward.com. And I'm also on Twitter at Kath Ryan Howard. And Distress Signals will be out in Ireland, in the UK, Australia, New Zealand, 9 months from now, June 2016. But there will be no escape, because when it does come out, I will be plastering it.
Absolutely.
Everywhere.
Quite right. Quite right. I look forward to it. But thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. For show notes and links, head to worriedwriter.com. If you'd like to connect, find me on Twitter at Sarah R. Painter, or use the hashtag Worried Writer. See you next time.